This evening we come to the third chapter in the section of the synthesis of yoga called the Yoga of Divine Works. This chapter is entitled Self-Surrender in Works, the Way of the Gita, and it first appeared on the 15th of March in 1915. And as with some of the other chapters that we've gone through already, Sri Aurobindo has heavily edited and revised it as he prepared it for publication. And the Way of the Gita suggests what is to come in the pages of the Arya. He has not written anything yet about the Gita explicitly in the Arya, although it weaves in and out of many of his essays, of course, up to this point, which is only a few months after the journal commenced. The Gita was quintessentially important to his own development spiritually. But he wouldn't begin writing about the Gita in a systematic way until he started essays on the Gita in August of 1916. So it would still be more than a year away before you would take it up. But he's giving us an adumbration of what his approach to the Gita is here. And his approach is brilliant. Sri Aurobindo brings back the full meaning of the Gita, not simply as a Vedantic teaching about a sublime transcendence which is extra cosmic, into which we can clamber through our yogic efforts, you know, and attain release, but is meant for life, is meant to ground us in spiritual action here and now. And he finds in the Gita a key to integration. It isn't fully worked out. It isn't fully worked out yet. We are still trying to integrate spirit in a way that it meaningfully changes our material existence, that consciousness can profoundly dig into and release hidden powers and possibilities that are inherent, must be inherent in matter. And so we continue to work on it. But Sri Aurobindo returns us to the Gita as that sort of a teaching from which we can draw inspiration, and which in its imagery of the Kurukshetra, the field of the Kurus, where the great battle is to commence between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, that is a depiction of everybody's life. We are beset by darkness, and we have to find our way to light, and we have to live really and truly to be able to succeed in what our spiritual mission is here. We can't simply walk away from the world. We must engage. So Sri Aurobindo, as you know, had his greatest opportunity to read the Gita when he was incarcerated in the Alipur jail outside of Calcutta, imprisoned by the British as he awaited and went through trial. He was there for, let's say, roughly a year. Already had a spiritual enlightenment of the Brahmic Nirvana, a release into the absolute which is beyond the world, which is outside the cosmos, and it brought into him great peace, tranquility. You can't say that Ananda was there. He said that himself. It wasn't that Ananda was present. That would develop later in his spiritual experience. But he went from that into something greater as he studied the Gita. And what he did within the first week or so, within the first 10 days of being in the Alipur jail, is to send a request to his wife, Mrinalini, that a few things be brought to him, which were permitted in the prison, but mostly books and the books that he wanted most, a copy of the Bhagavad Gita and a copy of some of the Upanishads. And he began to read the Gita and apply its teachings to how he viewed the world. And it led to the revelation before his vivid experience of the omnipresence of a supreme person embedded in all beings. Not simply was it outside the world, some faraway heaven, a God above, but a God immanent, immersed in this world, the world immersed in that God, and each individual, each form, each atom, whatever existence that he looked at, was that, and only that. So I think that we'll spend some time talking about the Gita. Not tonight. We'll read through this first section or so in this essay, which is basically a summation of what he's presented so far. And then we'll come to the teaching of the Gita, and we'll say a few words to set the stage for that next week. So chapter 3, Self-Surrender and Works, The Way of the Gita. Life. Not a remote, silent, or high-uplifted, ecstatic beyond. Life alone is the field of our yoga. Let me reread that. Life, not a remote, silent, or high-uplifted, ecstatic beyond life alone, is the field of our yoga. The transformation of our superficial, narrow, and fragmentary human way of thinking, seeing, feeling, and being into a deep and wide spiritual consciousness and an integrated inner and outer existence, and of our ordinary human living into the divine way of life, must be its central purpose. The means towards this supreme end is a self-giving of all our nature to the divine. Everything must be given to the divine within us, to the universal all, and to the transcendent supreme. An absolute concentration of our will, our heart, and our thought on that one and manifold divine, an unreserved self-consecration of our whole being to the divine alone. This is the decisive movement, the turning of the ego to that which is infinitely greater than itself, its self-giving and indispensable surrender. So you can see immediately how he's referred back to the previous chapter on self-consecration. Just by way of comparison, let me read to you how the first paragraph appeared in the Arya in 1915. Life is the field of our yoga. Transformation of ordinary human living into an integral divine life is its aim. Self-surrender of the ego to the divine, the all, the transcendent, is its path. Concentration of the will, the heart, the thought on the divine, and self-consecration to it of the whole being is the beginning of the path. The life of the human being, as it is ordinarily lived, is composed of four elements: action, desire, and emotion, and thought. So you can see how substantially he has recast the language, so it has much more the feel, the verve of what he was communicating to his fellow seekers in the ashram in the 30s. The turning of the ego to that away from the isolated self, fragmented from the world, split off, back to that which is infinitely greater, but still the same as, based on self-surrender, self-giving. The life of the human creature, as it is ordinarily lived, is composed of a half-fixed, half-fluid mass of very imperfectly ruled thoughts, perceptions, sensations, emotions, desires, enjoyments, acts, mostly customary and self-repeating, in part only dynamic and self-developing, but all centered around a superficial ego. The sum of movement of these activities eventuates in an internal growth which is partly visible and operative in this life, partly a seed of progress in lives hereafter. This growth of the conscious being, an expansion, an increasing self-expression, a more and more harmonized development of his constituent members, is the whole meaning and all the pith of human existence. It is for this meaningful development of consciousness by thought, will, emotion, desire, action, and experience, leading in the end to a supreme divine self-discovery, that man, the mental being, has entered into the material body. All the rest is that all the rest is either auxiliary and subordinate or accidental and otios. That only matters which sustains and helps the evolution of his nature and the growth, or rather, the progressive unfolding and discovery of his self and spirit. The aim set before our yoga is nothing less than to hasten this supreme object of our existence here. And that is, again, the supreme divine self-discovery, finding the hidden riches within. So that's the aim of his integral yoga. First, you have to find this inside you. Its process leaves behind the ordinary tardy method of slow and confused growth through the evolution of nature, because he has said that all life is yoga. Everything is developing, but in a tangled, confused, limited way. If you want to get there quickly, it means something has awakened in you. You've been chosen. You've been stirred into action. Your aspiration is alive. And now you can take that step. Have no doubt. If you're awake to the possibility, then you will be given the credible means by which you can arrive. For the natural evolution is at its best an uncertain growth undercover, partly by the pressure of the environment, partly by a groping education and an ill-lighted purposeful effort, and only partially illumined and half-automatic use of opportunities with many blunders and lapses and relapses. A great portion of it is made up of apparent accidents and circumstances and vicissitudes, though veiling a secret divine intervention and guidance. In yoga, we replace this confused, crooked crab motion by a rapid, conscious, and self-directed evolution which is planned to carry us, as far as can be, in a straight line towards the goal set before us. In a certain sense, it may be an error to speak of a goal anywhere in a progression which may well be infinite. Still, we can conceive of an immediate goal, an ulterior objective beyond our present achievement, towards which the soul in man can aspire. There lies before him the possibility of a new birth. There can be an ascent into a higher and wider plane of being, and its descent to transform his members. an enlarged and illumined consciousness is possible that shall make of him a liberated spirit and a perfected force. And if spread beyond the individual, it might even constitute a divine humanity, or else a new, a supermental, and therefore a superhuman race. It is this new birth that we make our aim. A growth into a divine consciousness is the whole meaning of our yoga, an integral conversion to divinity, not only of the soul, but of all the parts of our nature. So again, he sets the stage that he's described in detail in an earlier chapter. There is the ascent. There is the self-consecration, the self-surrender, the taking of all of our life's energies, of all of our thoughts, of all of our physical being, and directing it upwards in a coordinated, harmonious offering. That calls upon us a response, because the entirety of the offering opens us as a vessel to a descent of force, consciousness, ananda, from the real being above. If we seem to be divided here, there we are unified. If we seem to be dull and unaware here, there we are conscious. If we seem here to be insentient, immersed in neutrality of experience or suffering, there we have delight. And if we climb back to that, we have discovered our real source of being, which is cognate with the soul within us, and that commerce between the inner part of us and that higher reality ensures a fulfilling descent, which, when we feel it, we can drink into our members all the way to the bottom, and then undergo this conversion that Sri Aurobindo refers to here. And that's the new birth. Getting back to that means being born out of duality and out of ignorance, back into knowledge, back into the truth of being. Our purpose in yoga is to exile the limited outward-looking ego and to enthrone God in its place as the ruling inhabitant of the nature. And this means, first, to disinherit desire and no longer accept the enjoyment of desire as the ruling human motive. The spiritual life will draw its sustenance not from desire, but from a pure and selfless spiritual delight of essential existence. And not only the vital nature in us whose stamp is desire, but the mental being too must undergo a new birth and a transfiguring change. Our divided, egoistic, limited, and ignorant thought and intelligence must disappear. In its place, there must stream in the catholic and faultless play of a shadowless divine illumination, which shall culminate in the end in a natural, self-existent truth consciousness, free from groping half-truth and stumbling error. Our confused and embarrassed ego-centered, small-motived will and action must seize and make room for the total working of a swiftly powerful, lucidly automatic, divinely moved and guided, unfallen force. There must be implanted and activized in all our doings a supreme, impersonal, unfaltering, and unstumbling will in spontaneous and untroubled unison with the will of the divine. the unsatisfying surface play of our feeble egoistic emotions must be ousted, and there must be revealed instead a secret, deep, and vast psychic heart within that waits behind them for its hour. All our feelings, impelled by this inner heart in which dwells the divine, will be transmuted into calm and intense movements of a twin passion of divine love and manifold ananda. This is the definition of a divine humanity or a supramental race. This, not an exaggerated or even a sublimated energy of human intellect and action, is the type of Superman whom we are called to evolve by our yoga. So this last sentence obviously distinguishes the Superman of his conception as being fundamentally different from that of Friedrich Nietzsche, who saw the replacement, in a sense, the restoration of the vital ego of the human, but writ large as the Superman or Übermensch, not for Sri Aurobindo. 2, have the right enjoyment of life means that we no longer put an accent on desire for the vital satisfactions of life. We no longer see things through a limited perspective, which is characteristic of the human mind. So desire is quelled in the vital, and the ego is minimized in the mind. And then what one is able to find is the ananda of sat, the ananda of chit tapas, ananda itself. He's speaking here about the supramental consciousness being founded upon that triune being that we describe as sat chit ananda. It is this supramental consciousness into which our being can be exalted, not simply our mind, but all other elements of us ultimately come from that. They are distorted in the involution. They are separated and made small during the involution into the material and inconscient world, but still can be traced. There is a lineament that we can follow that leads us back to that. We can evolve out of the involution and recover through this supramental awareness, this supramental consciousness, this supramental beauty, the full figure of what is Satchit Ananda as it desires to be manifested in a divine desire, not a vitalistic desire. In the ordinary human existence, he writes, an outgoing action is obviously 3/4 or even more of our life. It is only the exceptions, the saint and the seer, the rare thinker, poet, and artist who can live more within themselves. These indeed, at least in the most intimate parts of their nature, shape themselves more in inner thought and feeling than in the surface act. But it is not either of these sides separated from the other, but rather a harmony of the inner and outer life made one in fullness and transfigured into a play of something that is beyond them, which will create the form of a perfect living. A yoga of works, a union with the divine in our will and acts, and not only in knowledge and feeling, is then an indispensable and inexpressibly important element of an integral yoga. The conversion of our thought and feeling without a corresponding conversion of the spirit and body of our works would be a maimed achievement. So Sri Aurobindo would, of course, spend hours in deep study of books or pouring out his writings in the Aria, later in Savitri. But you can see how important it is to him here that all of this should not be devoid of meaningful contact with the material life, but an expression of it. And I would ask you to remember that Sri Aurobindo did quietly impose a strong discipline upon his own physical being, that in the privacy, as we might say, of his inner chambers, he was practicing essentially a yoga that forced upon his body an immaculate, undisturbable peace, a nobility, a posturing in which the divine could place itself. And I think we've had the opportunity to bring to point before that our dear old friend K.D. Setna used to be given an opportunity to go into Mother's Lounge area and to take a rest, to get a break from the busyness of the day. And he would lie in a certain direction, and he could see the shadow of Sri Aurobindo as he came through the room. The sun would cast its light on Sri Aurobindo, and then his shadow would form against the wall. And of course, Sri Aurobindo did not want to be seen by all except his attendants, other than on the darshan days. So Setna was good enough to go to Mother and say, "You know, I can see Sri Aurobindo, at least his shadow, when from time to time he walks from one side of the room to the other while I'm resting. Should I be watching that?" And she said, "No." So he changed his position and then looked in a different direction so as not to see that. But he said what was remarkable was that Sri Aurobindo was in complete isolation. Nobody could see him. And yet his posture was magnificent. When he walked like the god he was. He didn't slouch. Instead, his head was erect and noble, looking out perhaps to the sea, with a great chest, a heart uplifted, posture absolutely erect, one hand over this, looking out at that. So just so, we can be. We can certainly appoint to ourselves rhythms that reflect the divinity within. Now, they need not always be magnificent postures. You have to breathe with the life of your soul. Krishna was playful, and there were times when he would joke and go mirthfully about playing pranks on people, capable of any posture, capable of any costuming that he wished. But the point is to live divinely, not to be driven by the outer parts of the nature, but to instead find the soul within and bring the soul's energies to bear in life, in the fashioning of our physical life too, and in the fashioning of our thoughts. They have a life. Your heart has a life. Your body has a life. And they all comport in one larger life. If you were to put the soul's power into mind, feeling, and your bodily posture, you would be a radiant example that is registering in the larger world. You would be taking a step towards the transformation of self and then of society. Important to consider. He continues, "But if this total conversion is to be done, there must be a consecration of our actions and outer movements as much as of our mind and heart to the divine." there must be accepted and progressively accomplished a surrender of our capacities of working into the hands of a greater power behind us, and our sense of being the doer and worker must disappear. You've read this before in the book The Mother. All must be given for a more direct use into the hands of the divine will, which is hidden by these frontal appearances. For by that permitting will alone is our action possible. Yes, truly, we do nothing. All is done from above by a greater consciousness and power than ours. But the more we live from our soul, the more it can act with fluency through us. A hidden power is the true Lord and overruling observer of our acts. And only He knows through all the ignorance and perversion and deformation brought in by the ego their entire sense and ultimate purpose. There must be effected a complete transformation of our limited and distorted egoistic life and works into the large and direct outpouring of a greater divine life, will, and energy that now secretly supports us. This greater will and energy must be made conscious in us and master. No longer must it remain as now, only a superconscious upholding and permitting force. There must be achieved an undistorted transmission through us of the all-wise purpose and process of a now hidden omniscient power and omnipotent knowledge, which will turn into its pure, unobstructed, happily consenting and participating channel all our transmuted nature. So here it is. This is the supramental action he describes in the replacement of the limited human ego by the conscious power of the divine. This total consecration and surrender, and this resultant entire transformation and free transmission, make up the whole fundamental means and the ultimate aim of an integral karma yoga. Even for those whose first natural movement is a consecration, a surrender, and a resultant entire transformation of the thinking mind and its knowledge, or a total consecration, surrender, and transformation of the heart and its emotions, the consecration of works is a needed element in that change. He will not let us escape from the necessity of karma yoga. Otherwise, although they may find God in other life, they will not be able to fulfill the divine in life. Life for them will be a meaningless, undivine inconsequence. Not for them, the true victory that shall be the key to the riddle of our terrestrial existence. Their love will not be the absolute love triumphant over self. Their knowledge will not be the total consciousness and the all-embracing knowledge. It is possible, indeed, to begin with knowledge or Godward emotion solely, or with both together, and to leave works for the final movement of the yoga. But there is then this disadvantage, that we may tend to live too exclusively within, subtilized in subjective experience, shut off in our isolated inner parts. There we may get encrusted in our spiritual seclusion and find it difficult later on to pour ourselves triumphantly outwards and apply to life our gains in the higher nature. When we turn to add this external kingdom also to our inner conquests, we shall find ourselves too much accustomed to an activity purely subjective and ineffective on the material plane. There will be an immense difficulty in transforming the outer life and the body. We've spent too much time away. Now we have to find the way back towards integration. Or we shall find that our action does not correspond with the inner light. It still follows the old accustomed, mistaken paths, still obeys the old normal imperfect influences. The truth within us continues to be separated by a painful gulf from the ignorant mechanism of our external nature. This is a frequent experience because in such a process, the light and power come to be self-contained and unwilling to express themselves in life or to use the physical means prescribed for the earth and her processes. It is as if we were living in another, a larger and subtler world, and had no divine hold, perhaps little hold of any kind, upon the material and terrestrial existence. But still, each must follow his nature. And there are always difficulties that have to be accepted for some time if we are to pursue our natural path of yoga. Yoga is, after all, primarily a change of the inner consciousness and nature. And if the balance of our parts is such that this must be done first with an initial exclusiveness and the rest left for later handling, we must accept the apparent imperfection of the process. Yet would the ideal working of an integral yoga be a movement, even from the beginning, integral in its process and whole and many-sided in its progress. In any case, our present preoccupation is with a yoga, integral in its aim and complete movement, but starting from works and proceeding by works, although at each step more and more moved by a vivifying divine love and more illumined by a helping divine knowledge. So a karma yoga, but also one full of heart and its rhapsodic union with the divine and knowledge, that is, an insight into the nature of the divine, which is omnipresent. So that's a great place to end for this evening, I think, and we'll take up his entrance into the Gita next time and say a few words in preparation for that too. For tonight, can look into Savitri, and this is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, on page 58. Yet a spiritual secret aid is there. While a tardy evolution's coils wind on, and nature hews her way through adamant, a divine intervention thrones above. Alive in a dead rotating universe, we whirl not here upon a casual globe, abandoned to a task beyond our force. Even through the tangled anarchy called fate, and through the bitterness of death and fall, an outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. It is near us in unnumbered bodies and births. In its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe the one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change, the crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever the appearance, we must bear. Whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. After we have served this great divided world, God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown, an anniversary of the birth sublime. Our soul shall justify its checkered walk. All will come near that now is naught or far. These calm and distant mites shall act at last. Immovably ready for their destined task, the ever-wise, compassionate brilliances await the sound of the incarnate's voice to leap and bridge the chasms of ignorance and heal the hollow, yearning gulfs of life and fill the abyss that is the universe. Here, meanwhile, at the Spirit's opposite pole, in the mystery of the deeps that God has built for his abode below the thinker's sight, in this compromise of a stark, absolute truth with the light that dwells near the dark end of things, in this tragic comedy of divine disguise, this long, far-seeking for joy ever near, in the grandiose dream of which the world is made, in this gold dome on a black dragon base, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast, a dark-robed laborer in the cosmic scheme, carrying clay images of unborn gods, executrix of the inevitable idea, hampered, enveloped by the hoops of fate, patient trustee of slow eternal time, absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. All she foresees in masked imperative depths. The dumb intention of the unconscious gulfs answers to a will that sees upon the heights, and the evolving word's first syllable, ponderous, brute-sensed, contains its luminous close, privy to a summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise. Namaste, Jai Ma.